Hey everybody, welcome to another spoiler edition of the Game of Thrones podcast on ballboot.com. I'm your host, Aaron.
I'm Jim.
And we're talking about episode 506.
Nope.
606. Blood of My Blood. Did I get that right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So right away, I wanted to get something out of the way, which is a bet I made with the listeners on the spoiler edition last year. And it turns out, special thanks to Olivia D., who went through the archives and found the quote at the 47-minute mark of the 507 spoiler edition. Well, let's just play the clip.
I will say this, if Benjen Stark shows up in episode 10, I will take red lipstick and I will write the word dick on my forehead for the live video version of our main podcast. That's how confident I am that he is not going to show up.
So there's an argument to be had here that the initial claim was if Benjen shows up before the last episode of season 5, mm-hmm. I would indeed write the word dick in red lipstick on my forehead for the live recording of the next following episode. However, that came and passed. Like, mm-hmm. I was really shitting bullets when they had Benjen Stark in the previously ons, but it turns out that was just to sell the lie that they told John about Benjen riding up to the gates to get him out of his quarters so they could stab him.
Hmm.
On the other hand, another argument could be made that the spirit of the bet was that I was so confident that this Benjen equals Cold Hands business was nonsense that I probably should wear the red dick lipstick anyway.
Hmm.
What do I get? Do I settle this with a trial by combat? Who do I fight? Who's my champion? Can I be like how do I resolve this? Because honestly, I was initially worried that I'd said something like Sharpie, and I really didn't want permanent marker dick on my forehead for 3 or 4 days until it wore off.
Yeah,
but lipstick, like, you know what? I don't
just wash that off. So here's the thing: I don't have the proper context for this. If you were all like, "Benjen Cold Hand Stark is not a thing. He's never coming back ever, ever, ever," and then you happen to slip up and say this season during the proclamation of the bet, then I would probably say, yeah, you need to do it. If that's not the case, then no. I mean, the letter of the bet was before the end of the season, as I heard it.
Oh, we're curious to see what the listeners
but
think,
yeah, because they probably have a better perspective on the context.
On the
here.
Other hand, they're probably right cunts, and they're going to want me to put the, you know, they just want from a pure schadenfreude kind of way, they want to see me with the word dick on my forehead. So
I think maybe you just have to put a capital D.
Capital D?
Yeah, just put the D.
Just the D, put the D on my head?
Uh-huh.
What if you just, like, draw a cock and balls?
Right, yeah.
The outline of it?
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I'm open to it, but I think I left myself enough wiggle room. Because here's the thing, like, I can't stress how much that this has been, while a popular theory, also kind of a laughingstock theory. And, like, you know, the Benjen is X and Dario equals X and Euron equals X become like a way to, when someone puts a crazy piece of unsupported tinfoil, that's like one of the top comments. Like, oh, and Benjen is going to be Euron or whatever.
Bet they're eating their fucking words now. Going frantically deleting comments.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, I don't even know that Benjen will be Cold Hands in the book because we've met Cold Hands.
Okay. Yeah.
So it seems like Benjen is a white. I looked in the second. It doesn't seem like his hands are kind of blackened the way it's described, and he certainly looks pale, and he's got fucking scars on his face. And I think that he's going to be revealed as undead.
Yeah.
And Cold Hands is certainly.
I thought they essentially revealed that.
I think so,
that.
Too. Like, if you've got a shard of obsidian in your heart, what are we talking about here?
Right.
You're not fully human. Of course, you could make the argument, the same argument about John. But in the books, we have Summer's point of view, the dog, and he describes him as smelling like decayed, rotting meat. But I always thought it was weird that, you know, again, I get he's got a cloak and he's kind of wreathed in darkness and whatnot, but I always thought it weird that Bran didn't know that that was his uncle.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how fucked up you can make one of my uncles to where I wouldn't recognize them by sound or by sight. And also, he... in the books, Cold Hands describes himself as being dead long ago. So that doesn't, like, you know, Benjen disappears at the start of Game of Thrones. That doesn't really track. Like, if he's talking about, oh, yeah, long ago, last year.
Yes, Bingen. So Bingen started out in the Night's Watch, yeah?
Yes,
in
the book. He was the first ranger.
Okay. Are we? Has Bran even met him? Do we know that?
Like, oh, yeah. Yeah, because he came to the Winterfell when King Robert was there in the first season and in the first book, so as part of that festivities. He got leave from the Night's Watch to go down there and visit with his family.
Yeah, I don't remember any of that.
So, yeah, he's definitely... I would think Bran would recognize him.
Yeah.
But no, and that's the thing. Like, this could be a Martin's Razor situation where... in the books, Cold Hands might be, you know, chilling his heels as cold as they are outside the cave waiting for Bran to come forth, and he protects them and then furthers his education. And he might not be Bingen at all, but Martin's Razor says, well, if we're going to introduce an undead wight, we've got Bingen that's already up here. It's a recognizable character. So I'm of multiple minds about this whole thing.
Okay.
But, like, I really, you know, like I said, I would have fought harder had I stuck with the scorpion thing, because there's, and the scorpion's gone now, so there's no way I could hold that bet anyway.
Mm-hmm. We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret, Hush Hush. No hints, except it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of King's Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Okay, so let's stay on the Bingen topic for a bit, since we're already there. Cat D said, I want to email on the wider implications of the show's Bingen reveal. If Bingen was cured from turning into a wight by having dragonglass plunged into his heart, couldn't this drastically change the context of any future Nyssa-style sacrifices? Azor Ahai had to temper his sword by plunging it into water, then a lion's heart, and then his wife's heart, as we've discussed many, many times before. Mm-hmm. But on the show, Valyrian steel and dragonglass seem to have the same magical properties. In this context of the White Walker invasion, is it possible that Azor Ahai would be saving his wife by plunging his sword into her heart? I think Kat is suggesting here that maybe Nyssa was turned into a White Walker, and this thing wasn't so much as a sacrifice, but as a saving event.
I suppose that's possible. Now, the one wrinkle I would say is we don't know if like Obsidian is the thing that actually does it, or if it's some power that the Children of the Forest have, that could also be the case.
Well, the only thing I'd say about that is unless the Children of the Forest are going around and blessing like all the Obsidian in the land, although I guess they found the cache, which could have been those things, as far as we know, could have been hand chipped by the Children of the Forest and blessed with their holy water or whatever they do to make it magic.
I'm not talking about like being able to kill a White Walker with it. I'm talking about like specifically being able to stop someone from turning into a white or bring them back or whatever.
And we're certainly
that might
not
be just the ritual that does that.
And we're certainly not sure that Valyrian steel could do the same thing, because that's not a technology created by the Children of the Forest.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it is an interesting idea. Yeah. I do kind of like that maybe you could look at that statement in a different light.
Like, there's this transitive property that might, you could say, well, since this does this, then in this occasion, then it might also do just as well.
But, yeah, I think you do have to say it might or maybe or something like that.
Yes. But that's what's cool about this season is it's kind of blowing the lid off of and strengthening other theories. Like, you know, none of this was talked about at all before this this season. So we're going to talk about more about the possible Lightbringer, Azor Ahai, Nisa stuff later. But I wanted to get into corrections because I forgot to do corrections last week. It was a casualty of cutting and pasting. I didn't intentionally mean to just ignore it. Bruden Person comes up first with the correction that not all Targaryens had the silver hair. And I did do research, and there's about a dozen canonical Targaryens that had black hair and black eyes, or brown hair and black eyes. And so it's not a 100% sure thing that they all have silver hair and purple eyes. The reason he also illuminates the reason in the books that Euron, I don't think this is a correction so much as an illumination. The reason in the books that Euron has been gone was because he fucked Victarion's wife and was banished for it. In the show, they literally made it out like he's just been off fucking around on a ship gallivanting. I don't know that's an important distinction to make. It would be in the books because it explains one of the reasons the Victarion turns against his brother. Like, not only does he think he's a shit because he just doesn't follow the laws of his people, but also he raped his wife. And then that, you know, the interesting thing is Victarion then kills his wife as like an honor killing. So there's that. But that's the reason, and Balon kind of to make peace and keep his house from being torn apart and banished Euron for that. Murder Bear on the forum said, Ashara Dane is the sister of Arthur Dane and not his wife, which I totally fucked that up. That's on me.
You know, easily confused in this world.
Sure. I thought, I'm pretty sure that she also threw herself off of the castle walls after he died, which... That's, I think, why I thought that she was his wife, because that's an pretty extreme reaction for a sister.
Yeah, I guess so.
I mean, I'm not that attached to my sister. I wouldn't throw myself off the roof of the apartment if she died. I'd be sad.
Right.
I'd be sad, sure, but I wouldn't be inconsolable. Jukebox Hero wanted to clean up some of the Summer Hall and kidnapping of Aerys stuff, because I completely conflated like three different events as one, and I knew I would do that when I was just kind of going off the cuff, but here's the actual timeline of events for those that are curious. The tragedy at Summer Hall happened about 40 years before the current events of the book or show. It was a gathering to celebrate the birth of Rhaegar Targaryen, the brother of Dany, who was born on the same day. A massive fire burned down the castle and essentially killed everyone except Rhaella, which is Aerys' wife, and Rhaegar's mother, and the baby Rhaegar. It's not exactly known what's caused the fire, but there's speculation that dragon eggs and the trying to hatch same, which is what I was referring to, played a role. Then, 50 years after that, or about 25 years before the proper start of the series, Aerys was held hostage by House Darklyn of Duskendale. And when Tywin marched his army down to resolve the situation, Lord Dennis threatened to kill Aerys the moment Tywin or his men made any attempt to breach the city, which made Tywin kind of back off and try to wait out him by sieging the city. And Barristan Selmy went on a covert mission to rescue King Aerys. Once he was freed, the entire House of Darkland was executed, with the exception of the young child Dontas Hollard, that Barristan insisted to be spared because he was just a kid. Aerys then became paranoid and became sure that Tywin and Rhaegar planned to lay siege to Duskendale in order to provoke them into killing him so that Rhaegar could become king and no one would lay blame at their feet. And he didn't leave the Red Keep after that out of paranoid fear. So he essentially misjudged Tywin, who was a loyal hand of the king, and his son, and kind of became paranoid. Now, a lot of people said that, you know, Aerys had kind of started to go crazy long before that, because he was the product of almost 300 years of inbreeding and incest at that point, and he had a lot of his children were sickly and died either in birth or very young, and just the tragedy of all that kind of driven him mad. But also, Dontas Hollard, the boy that was spared. I did not remember this, but he was the fool that Joffrey kind of humiliated.
Okay.
And tried to pour wine down his throat. And he's the one that helped Sansa poison Joffrey and helped her flee King's Landing before Littlefinger murdered him. Mm-hmm. So now you know the rest of the story. I think that's an accurate summation of those two events now. And it had nothing to do with the previous thing that happened with Dunk and Egg and the you know destruction of a lot of Targaryens there, which was about 100 years in the past. Hmm. Okay, Michael S. Asserts that in the World of Ice and Fire, which is the compendium that George Martin released last year that kind of has like the whole history of Westeros, according to this book, the Maesters do not believe the world is flat. They believe it is round, and they actually call the known world Earth and not Planetos,
yep.
And even refer to the planet revolving around the sun. So that kind of
okay.
Puts a kibosh on the whole Dany selling, you know, sailing the opposite way to the globe to get to the opposite side of Westeros.
Right.
He also said that according to So Spake Martin archive, Martin said we will never see a Shai in the books, which is the final kibosh in her sailing east to go west.
Right. And also a little kibosh on the stuff we talked about with Jorah maybe going there. And a lot of stuff we talked about.
The only thing I would say to that is that there's already so many differences between the books and the show that if the Double D's decided they wanted to go that way instead of involving a three-part plan with dragon horns and all this other stuff, that maybe they do that just to simplify things.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know.
That's
impossible. I mean, there's no way to know.
They call this planet Earth. That's canon.
I didn't look this up to verify it because that book, I don't know if you've seen it, it's like a fucking telephone book.
I'm sure, yeah.
And it does have an index and whatnot, but I'm just taking Michael at his word here. I'm hoping he's not
I'm picturing somewhat of like a TNG technical manual or something.
Well, and that's the other thing when you talk about works of fantasy. Like, they're speaking the common tongue, not English. So is this a rough translation? Like, Earth is not... Is Earth originally referred to the ground you stand on? It later became right. Our planet. So what does that even mean?
Sure. But if he's saying they actually refer to the planet as Earth,
yeah,
I don't know how that tracks. I have no fucking clue how that would be the case.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of there's a lot of ways you could make this literally be our Earth. Number one, you got magic, so you got magic seasons. And number two, this is way in the future. I don't think it could possibly be in the past.
Absolutely not.
But it could be way into the future.
Yeah.
Like hundreds of millions of years, such that the continents have drifted to where they're in the configuration they are in Westeros.
I suppose so.
But I would I honestly would just rather go with the fact that this is just a translation.
Okay.
You know, like, they call their moon the moon, too, and they call their sun the sun.
Mm-hmm.
That's a further... I mean, does that mean they're literally in our solar system with the moon, or is that just what...
No, I mean, I think the sun is not the proper name of that ball of fire. It's solar, right? So,
well, Earth isn't the proper name for, like... Isn't scientifically it's Terra?
I'm not sure about that.
It's like the moon is actually Luna. Isn't like the moon is a generic, right. Like you capitalize it and you know it's our moon, but our moon is actually Luna.
Yes. There are many moons.
And the sun is actually called the solar system.
Yeah.
But I mean, this is all
like, right. It's like, who cares ultimately?
If the plot of A Song of Ice and Fire revolves around our understanding of astronomical terms, then it's a completely different story than the one I think he's telling. But I did want to issue those corrections. Francesca said, I have to ask, since we're around the same period of time as some parts of Dance, what do you think happened to us with the Sir John Connington and Young Griff storyline? Do we assume as book readers that this is a total red herring from Germ to thicken the plot and make it harder for Dany to cross the narrow sea? Or is it just further proof that the book and the TV series are two different stories, especially since Jorah is the one who gets grayscale in the show as opposed to the banished John Connington? I was really intrigued by this plot in the books, and I'm sad, along with the apparent lack of Lady Stoneheart, that it seems like it won't be appear in the TV series. I've talked about this in, I think, the very first podcast this season, but my theory is all of this stuff was spawned when George wrote the big prophecies that happen in A Storm of Swords, or is it Clash of Kings, whichever the second book is. And he got to the Danny and he started just, you know, all these ideas started spinning forth. And he has all this like multiple three-part prophecies that Danny's hit with in House of the Undying as like, you know, all the clues of what she's going to face, all the pretenders and all the supplicants and all the true allies and all the false friends that she's going to go have to go through as clues to kind of help her navigate this. And then he got to write the story and he's like, oh, shit. And he has to actually have all this stuff pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And I think John Connington is literally just to fulfill like the Mummer's Dragon part of the, you know, I think the Mother of Lies part of the prophecy, which we're going to talk about a bit here in the podcast as well. So I think that the fact that Jorah took the grayscale plot or somehow implies that that grayscale is going to be significant. But the fact that they Martin's razored him, and if you're not familiar with that term, that's something I coined a couple seasons back to describe what the Double D's like to do, which is to take two or three plots or characters from the books and consolidate them into one character that does kind of all the things that the other characters were, you know, to do to simplify the story. Because mm-hmm. this show's already got 75 arguably main characters.
Right.
I think the fact that they've Martin Razor John Connington into Jorah implies that we're not going to get that. And I do believe that ultimately in the books that's going to be a minor footnote in the, you know, War of Westeros.
What are you going to write on your head if John Connington shows up?
I'm not that's the thing. I'm not certain. But the fact that, you know, right. as we go deeper in its stream of time, and now we have, what, 13 plus, we have 17 episodes left. You know, I was pretty confident that the Greyjoys were to come back. They did introduce those, and it took an episode or two to do it. How many more episodes do we have to establish something like, you know, the John Connington Griff stuff?
Sure.
And that was all tied into Tyrion's plot. I mean, that stuff seems like it was pretty irrevocable, but... Mm-hmm. I've been wrong before, and I'm not issuing any more bets. Let's talk about general Lightbringer theories. I want to talk about Valyrian swords in general because I got several, I feel like, emails identifying every single Valyrian sword we know in existence and arguments for why it might play a part in the wars to come.
Well, I know about Heartsbane now.
Well, that's the thing, like... If there's a Valyrian sword, it wouldn't surprise me if it doesn't get used against the White Walkers in the future.
Yeah, calling all swords sort of thing.
But that's such, like, I'm completely uninterested in saying what I think is an obvious fact. And some of them might be lost, and some of them might be found. And, you know, I'm looking for things that are actually significant. Having said that, there is a whole bunch of, you know, Lightbringer does seem to be a significant sword, and it's a big piece of the prophecy that's wrapped up in the prince that was promised, or Azor Ahai.
Mm-hmm.
Megan H. offers, what if the water element was already satisfied by Jon killing the White Walker at Hardhome? Since these guys seem to basically be made of ice, the connection between ice and water is easy to make here. Longclaw is already in its first quenching process.
Yeah, I suppose that could be right.
I've got another theory Alex K. puts forth. Is it possible the water that Jon must quench Lightbringer in is Davos Seaworth? He seems to be the only water element in close proximity to Jon on a regular basis, and it would be emotionally traumatic.
I don't know about that.
Well, I mean, he's Seaworth. It's literally why. Well, I mean, you could Theon Greyjoy. Like, he's a Kraken. He's associated to Sea.
Right, but he's not close by. Like, that's.
Well, now.
That's what he's going for, is like proximity, right?
When
like,
he gets a hold of Littlefinger's jetpack.
Well, sure. Then all is possible. But for now, yeah, Davos is the closest thing. But I think maybe the White Walker thing is.
Okay.
The best bet at the moment.
Louis C. wants to know, do you think Heartsbane is going to be Lightbringer? Perhaps the name alludes to it having been quenched in someone's heart.
Hmm. So it's already kind of got a head start on the other swords?
Well, this might... So there's two competing kind of theories, and there's sub-theories on each. That Lightbringer is a sword that's already extant in the world, and it's just waiting for someone to discover either it or its true identity as another blade. Which okay. I think is this part of the theory. And there's another theory gotcha. That Lightbringer could be any sword that is... gone through a particular process or wielded by a particular person
mm-hmm.
And has a special power against the White Walkers.
Could Jon dual wield? Could he go with Heartsbane as Lightbringer and also Longclaw?
I don't know. I mean, so Longclaw is like one of those hand-and-a-half bastard swords.
Yeah, it's a big sword. Great sword? Is that what they're called?
Well, no, Heartsbane's a great sword. The Longclaw is a bastard sword. So you could arguably dual-wield, but a great sword and a bastard sword?
It'd be tough. She'd have to do even more working out.
It appeared that Sir Arthur Dane was dual-wielding great swords.
Oh, jeez.
And I know I've seen a couple other knights do that as well on the show. My problem with the Heartsbane equals Lightbringer theory is, number one, Heartsbane seems like it's kind of just a badass martial term. It's not having, it's not Heart's Blessing or Heart's Savior or Heart's going to beat back the darkness. It's Bane of Hearts, which I guess it, if it plunged through Nisa and it wasn't Dragon Glass and didn't save her from being a White Walker or a white, then maybe there's something to that. But the fact that they even said in this episode it's only been in the family for 500 years or so, which is entirely consistent with them buying it from Old Valyria, which was not yet blown up. It could be that this is a more ancient blade that just came into the family, but to me, the 500-year limit seems to say, no, this isn't Lightbringer. And all the other stuff I said, too.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
We've got lots of ongoing coverage this week, from book versus show comparisons for Hot D to the latest very special episode of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? But there are a couple of main events this week you need to know about.
Firstly, we've got a brand new commission podcast out this Tuesday covering the Raid 2, sometimes subtitled Retaliation. If you're a fan of martial arts films, this is one you don't want to miss. Iko Uwe is a rising star in the action movie world, and it's easy to see why. Join us on Tuesday as we dive into the bigger, badder sequel to The Raid, try and figure out which is better.
Then on Thursday, we're covering the season finale of Hulu's excellent period drama, Shogun. We've been waiting all season to see what Toranaga Sama's plan is, or if he even has one. It all comes down to this, and we couldn't be more excited. Join us on Thursday for what's sure to be an epic Shogun season finale podcast, and to find out if we plan to cover any related materials.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
We're about 10 weeks out from House of the Dragon Season 2, and it's time to prepare for war.
Which in our case means, watching a lot of Hot D and reading a lot of Fire and Blood.
Each week between now and June 16th, Maester Anthony and his co-host Steve are hosting a watch of each episode of Hot D Season 1. And then me and Jim are going to host a discussion of the differences between the events on that episode and how they're recounted in George R.R. Martin's historical tome, Fire and Blood.
That's right, I've resorted to reading dragon books. God help us all. We'll see if my fresh eyes add any new insights or predictions into Season 2.
Arm yourselves with all the lore you can for the battles ahead. House of the Dragon returns June 16th, but we've got you covered until then.
Check out all of our upcoming Hot D coverage on the Hot D feed or on Bald Move Pulp, available wherever you listen to podcasts.
John G says, you spoke last episode about how Longclaw could possibly fit into the Azor Ahai Lightbringer prophecy, but I believe Oathkeeper is being overlooked as the most likely sword to be Lightbringer if it's in fact a physical sword. Keep in mind, I cut several other just, what about this sword? What about this sword theories?
Okay.
So Lightbringer must be tempered in water, a lion, and a lover's heart. Oathkeeper is made from Valyrian steel that was originally called ice, therefore water, and was then forged into a Lannister sword, which is, of course, their house symbol is a lion. Considering the fact that in A Dance with Dragons we see Brienne luring Jaime into a Lady Stoneheart trap, I find it very unlikely that both Jaime and Brienne are going to make it out of Lady Stoneheart's clutches. Your eyebrows raised at that. Do I need to explain that a bit more?
Which part?
About the Brienne luring Jaime into a Lady Stoneheart trap.
Yes, I don't know exactly what that means. Okay. Also, my eyebrows raise anytime I hear Lady Stoneheart.
Because you're just excited.
I'm ready for it, yep.
Your spire is forming. Okay, so Brienne and Podrick come across Lady Stoneheart, who is on an insane vengeance streak against all Freys and all Lannisters.
Okay.
And all Boltons.
All right.
And Brienne shows up wearing very fine armor, not the armor that Catelyn last saw her in, and bearing the Oathkeeper blade, which has a prominent Lannister lion on its hilt, and essentially accuses her of treason against her.
Mm-hmm.
And she proceeds to start to hang Podrick and Brienne, and she gives them the choice that you can either choose the rope or the sword, with the sword implying that Lady Stoneheart says the way you can make this up to me is by killing Jaime Lannister, who is now in the Riverlands.
Hmm. Okay.
Towards the very end of the books, there is a scene where Brienne approaches Jaime and asks him to come with her, and that's kind of where the story ends. So a lot of people are speculating that this is going to lead him into, as they say, a Lady Stoneheart trap.
Okay.
Okay, so with all that out of the way, I think we could see Brienne allowing Jaime to kill her, or the other way around, in order to fulfill the third requirement of the Lightbringer prophecy, thus making Oathkeeper Lightbringer. With the romantic relationship that develops between Jaime and Brienne, that's assuming a lot, but I agree with that analysis, so I'm going to allow it. I think it's very possible that Brienne becomes Jaime's Nissa Nissa, or Jaime could be Brienne's Nissa Nissa, considering that both Jaime and Brienne are POV
this
characters.
This is what Jar Jar calls his girlfriend. Nissa Nissa.
What he calls is the daughter of his brother.
Okay. Is that what that means? What the fuck is a Nissa Nissa?
It is very pizza pizza, isn't it? Like,
it's the most pizza pizza.
It's a pretty goofy name. Like, yeah. It's right up there with some of the Tolkien goofy ones. The Bombers and Blofers and...
Right. Bilbos.
Yeah. And... Glory Hole, I think, is one of the High Elves.
Uh-huh. What's Nissa Nissa? Is it just the name of a character?
Yeah, it's the wife of the prince that was promised, and that she's the one that got the sword plunged into her heart.
Oh, okay, yes.
But she does have a ridiculous name.
Yeah, she does.
Considering that both of them are POV characters, either would be a huge sacrifice, as Nissa Nissa was, thus fulfilling the Lightbringer prophecy. Some side evidence to support this theory is that in the books, both Oathkeeper and Widow's Wail are described as having a strange red glow to them, and that the show took the time to show ice being melted down in Oathkeeper and Widow's Wail in the beginning of season 4. I don't know that it has a strange red glow. It's just that the Tywin explained kind of like in a gloating way that the Forger had a way to give it like a red sheen or patina,
yeah.
To go with the crimson of their house.
Gotcha.
So it was like a further kind of bespoiling of Ned's blade. And the other obvious theory with this problem is that implies that either Jaime or Brienne is Azor Ahai. Yeah?
Unless they can just hand it off to Jon and be like, here you go, bud, I quenched this.
I mean, you're talking about a prophecy that's 8,000 years old. Mm-hmm. There's, you know, I have always thought, and I've talked about this in previous podcasts, that I'm skeptical that literally one man with one sword turned the tide of the battle against the White Walkers.
Right.
That to me, this is kind of like a Noah's Flood kind of story, that it's trying to tell you something else about something that was important to the people at the time, that, like, you know, a lot of sacrifice and a lot of blood and a lot of sweat were spilled to do something really, really hard to turn these things back. Because it seems anti-Game of Thrones, Song of Ice and Fire to have, like, a literal magic sword that pew-pew-pews mm-hmm. all the White Walkers. Having said that, Jon touches one with a Valyrian steel blade and they burst into ice, so what the hell do I know?
Yeah.
But I don't think, like, Jon could just grab a sword and just start hacking his way and win the thing single-handedly.
No, I don't think so.
I mean, what the hell does that even look like? How would you film something like that? I mean,
and he's just spinning. He's just spinning, constantly spinning
sure.
with a sword.
I mean, or you could go like the Fifth Element route, where like literally a beam of light comes and just go, pushes them all back. I don't know, but Brienne as Azor Ahai is actually, I did some research and it's a surprisingly popular theory too, because she's
really?
So virtuous and she has this sword ice. Mm-hmm. And people say that, like, she very well might have to kill Jaime to satisfy her loyalty to Catelyn.
Mm-hmm.
And that would be plunging the blade into the heart of a lion. But then you got to think, like...
And it would be a sacrifice maybe for her as well?
Sure, because I do think she, if she loves Jamie in a brothers at arms kind of way and a mm-hmm. kindred spirit and as a tragic figure, even if she doesn't love him like in a lover kind of way.
Yeah. And maybe he's really cold at the time, so it just satisfies all of it.
Well, that's the thing. Like, you could, like, if she's already got ice that's been melted down, okay, it's already... And also, I'm pretty sure they probably quenched the sword in water. I mean, that's part of the forging process, so that's mm-hmm. already kind of baked into every one of these fucking swords.
That's true.
If she plunges into the heart of a lion who's also her lover, mm-hmm. that would just fulfill everything all at once.
Seems like it.
And she's, you know, if you gotta think of someone who's, like, an almost uncorruptible good.
Yeah.
Even more so than John, who's already broken some vows and done some things that are questionable. I mean, I think he always had good intentions, but were questionable. Mm-hmm. You know, Brienne is kind of that character. She is like what you want out of a knight in Westeros. So I could see it, in as much as I can see any theory where one single person is responsible for beating back the White Walkers. Let's move on. Bethany P. said, do we know that the Night's King was a normal man? Perhaps he was also a green seer, and that's how you could see Bran. I mean, no, we don't.
No.
We're going to talk about several theories here and some of the conflicts between what the books have told us so far and what we've... Well, and we've talked about it a bit on previous podcasts, but hold on to that idea. I think the Night's King wants to turn Bran into a White Walker, continues Bethany. If you could force Bran to join the dark side, you could rule the world. We know the Night King can transform human babies into White Walkers. The mark on Bran's arm seems like his skin has turned to a bluish, icy color of the White Walkers. Potentially could spread. What do you think about this theory? That the ultimate goal for the Night King is...
I mean, assuming it's possible, which yeah. I don't know if it even is, but yeah, he could probably do a lot of damage if he were to convert the Three-Eyed Raven.
It also seems like it might be enough just to kill him, because I do feel it feels like the Night's King is just powerful enough that he could just continue steamrolling through Westeros, if he can get past the wall.
Right. Now, I do think Bran is going to be key in stopping him. I think he's got a big part to play in that. But so I could see like where if he can kill if he can kill Bran, that's great. If he could turn Bran, that'd probably be gravy.
Sure. Like, it's like the whole Vader, he'll join us or die thing. With
right.
Like, join best, die, also pretty good.
Yeah.
And I still like the idea of Bran going through the wall and, like, destroying it because of the mark. I totally disagree that this is a mark that's going to, like, spread.
Like, oh, no, I don't think so.
And he's, like, already turning into a White Walker. I don't... Because that would be something the Three-Eyed Crow would say. Like,
yeah. That well, mark, too late.
Yeah, like that mark, it allows him to come here. Also, you're fucked. You're going to be a white unless you get an obsidian dagger stabbed in your heart. So here, brace. This is going to pinch.
Yeah.
You're going to feel some pressure, some discomfort. Yeah.
No, I thought it was like a tracking, just sort of a tracking
sure.
Marker for him.
Daniel J., I could get your thoughts on one thing, it would be, what do you think about the blue-eyed king that casts no shadow from Dany's vision in the House of the Undying? Because prophecies usually involve such terse descriptions, the fact that the eye color is mentioned at all always seemed to me to indicate that the king was another. And cast no shadow has a vampiric undead quality to it as well. I'm kind of just thinking this blue-eyed king could be just as easily the Night's King, but picturing the Night's King wielding a red, i.e. flaming sword is confusing. It is also possible that we're headed for the biggest mindfuck at all, that the Night's King and Azor Ahai are one and the same. Just off the cuff, what do you think of that theory?
That Azor Ahai and the Night's King are the same guy?
Yeah. I mean, what does it even mean?
I mean, that'd be a real bummer for the people who believe in that prophecy.
It'd be like saying G.I. Joe and Cobra and Commander are the same. Like,
right.
Then what?
Are they working against themselves?
Like, yeah.
Each identity is working against the other.
I mean, clearly the Night's King came before Azor Ahai, even if he is a real legendary figure. Like, Azor Ahai fought against the White Walkers. The White Walker was created, which led to the threat. Ergo, Azor Ahai cannot be the White Walker. I also have some...
Okay.
The conventional wisdom in this prophecy is that this is Stannis... So there's all these three-part prophecies, and they're all saying, like, you know, Daenerys, mother of dragons, and they give a three-part prophecy about dragons, and one of them is, like, the Mummer's Dragon, which I think is the fake Aegon thing. But this is part of the Slayer of Lies litany, And I think that this is just a naked reference to Stannis, because Stannis has got blue eyes. He wields a fake, a lying red sword, because it's trickery from Melisandre. And he casts no shadow, because his shadow was used to kill his brother. And we know that shadow looked a lot like Stannis. So I think it's right. A prophetic warning to Dany of things that are going to come in Westeros. Now, it didn't really have anything to do with Dany. But yeah. Then again, Dany also saw a vision of Robb dying in the Red Wedding that had nothing really to do with her. Some of this stuff was just, sure. Yo, here's current events that yeah. You might not be aware of.
Okay, so that sounds reasonable.
I think that's where, like, I don't get too excited about the blue eyes. Stannis has blue eyes, he had a red blade, and he had a shadow that was hinky. So it's a done deal for me until proven otherwise. Daniel continues... Now that we know so much more about the history of the others, assuming the books will at least follow the origin story, it does make some of their actions in earlier books more meaningful upon reflection.
Who are the others?
The others and the White Walkers are used interchangeably.
Okay, I didn't know that.
I think the others is the book term that the Double D's discussed in the first season changing because Lost was still so part of the consciousness.
That's what I think of immediately when I hear it.
Exactly, and they didn't want any kind of preconceptions. Okay. It does, so for instance, the fact that they spared the life of the Crow in the initial search party, the one that eventually came down south and was beheaded by Ned, it's possible they wanted him to go back south of the Wall and tell them what they saw, sparking more search parties and drawing more prey out north of the protection of the Wall where they'd be vulnerable to them. But it's also possible they spared the Crow trying to communicate with mankind, the fact that they leave their bodies of their victims in patterns which we now know originate with the Children of the Forest, feels like they're trying to leave a clue as to their origin. Maybe they understand that the humans have false myths about them and want to spill the beans on what the Children of the Forest did in creating them. Or maybe they're like a demented demigod in the Gnostic myth, a warped vision of an artificial intelligence or an original intelligence that's not even aware of its own imperfections and carries on creating in the only ways it knows how, revealing something of its creator but in a twisted way. What do you make of these use of patterns or purposeful sparing of an enemy's life?
I do think they mean something. Those patterns aren't there for no reason. Yeah. Now, I don't know if they're there purely for the viewer of the show or if they're there for the in-universe characters to discover. I couldn't tell you there.
One thing that I've been thinking about is, like, one of the really popular theories previous to this season was that the reason the White Walkers are coming is because mankind collectively has fucked up some kind of ancient agreement to sure. either supply them with children or to, I mean, just keep on their side of the Wall. I don't really, you know, there's a lot of different theories, and I did a whole podcast on them back in season 4. But it feels like that's less a possibility now, that these are automated weapons that the children deployed and that they weren't, there wasn't a covenant between them made so much as they were beat back and separated from Westeros by a wall.
Mm-hmm.
Do you agree with that?
It seems like it. I mean, based on the history that we learned in the show recently with the Children of the Forest, I guess so.
I mean, I guess they could have been. It wasn't like a complete conquering, but like a ceasefire, so that could still be on the table, but it just doesn't...
Yeah, there's a big gap there between the creation of them and the history that she tells about, and then modern day, so...
Yeah. I want to also consider this thing from Zach R. saying, in the podcast, you discussed the possibility that the Night King from the show and the Night's King in the books are the same person. In the show, it is the children who created the very first White Walker, who we know as the Night King. In the books, however, the Night's King is the Lord Commander of the Night's Watch, who lived during the Age of Heroes, also their 13th Lord Commander. This story goes that he fell in love with the White and took the Night Fort as their castle, probably becoming a White or White Walker in the process, and later be killed because of it. The Night's King could not be the first White Walker because the Night's Watch was created to protect the realm from the White Walkers, which means they were already a threat before the Night's King was turned, which we've kind of discussed already. Furthermore, being the 13th Lord Commander, one would assume there was considerable amount of time between the 1st and 13th Lord Commander. Old Nan is also quoted as saying, the Night's King was a man only by light of day, but at the night was his to rule. I know Old Nan's stories are introduced as stories, but a lot of her stories end up being true. A small distinction, one which I doubt they will make in a show, but interesting one nonetheless. I am increasingly thinking this whole thing about the Night's King... and a 13th Lord Commander, and the fact he was an ancient Stark, and he fell in love with another, and got his dick froze off and became a White Walker. That seems completely apocryphal in this in the light of the new information that we've learned. Right?
I think so. It seems like a ridiculous story on the face of it. I don't know how you fall in love with a White Walker.
Well, I mean, he literally looked over the wall one night and saw her beauty reflected in the moonlight, and it's kind of like a King David and Bathsheba situation. He's like, I gotta get me some of that ice cold pussy.
Jesus, man. I mean, you're so you're gonna break your vows for that?
Well, that's the thing. Like, we're thinking of the White Walkers as being these butthole faced, horny, right. Buffoons, but. You know, I guess you could have a sexy White Walker.
I don't know why not.
Isn't there canonical instances of zombie prostitutes?
Well, it depends on how much credit you want to give Z Nation for being canon. But sure,
I thought there was a Romero movie or something with that too. Or no?
I can say this for sure. I am
like
certain
an Italian zombie flick that they got down with.
I am certain that someone has fucked a zombie in fiction.
What about that Peter Jackson? Like, two zombies fucked each other and got pregnant, yeah?
Right, yeah.
Okay. Well, here's the thing. Like, what if you're the Lord Commander and you're not allowed to have sex with women?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
I found a loophole. I found the loophole, guys.
She's not a woman. No one will deny that. Like, maybe after a couple decades, that starts looking pretty good.
And they were like, well, yes, technically you're right, but you go out and try it first.
Yeah.
And then froze off and sorry.
No, but I'm saying that Nan is wrong. I'm just saying that she's repeating legends and stories that have a kernel of truth to them, but have been just lost in the mist of the 8,000 year history of this thing. Like, even a 13th Lord Commander, if we're on Lord Commander 999. If Ed is, in fact, the 999th Lord Commander, that's a shit ton of time. Oceans and oceans of times. And, you know, how in the world could you keep all that shit straight? Like, you know, we don't know. Like, literally, well, we're barely aware of the 8,000-year history of the planet Earth.
Sure.
You know, I'm not implying that Earth on 8,000. I'm saying that, like, the civilizations
recorded
in Egypt
history.
That has, like, you know, tablets and hieroglyphics and stuff are from about that time. And we know a lot of that because we have advanced archaeological techniques and we've recovered it and been able to find, like, the Rosetta Stone allows us to translate a lot of this stuff and go further back. How in the hell could Westeros possibly keep all this information? Especially since it's been it's been invaded, like, two other times by other people, you know? Like,
yeah, I don't know.
I don't know. So that's my thoughts on that. Brett J., said, I emailed you a few weeks ago about the idea of the bloodied sword Dawn being carried up the stairs of the Tower of Joy by Ned, and that being linked to being born beneath a bleeding star. Interestingly, one of the still shots in Bran's flash recall is of the past is Ned saying, "Where's my sister?" And the next shot is a very bloody hand. Maybe Ned has to use Dawn to perform an emergency C-section on Lyanna. The books talk about how her gown was spattered with gore, and this slow death would allow Lyanna to make sure Ned promises her, and he would be so guilty going forward that he could arguably or basically killed his sister.
I've all but decided that that's exactly how it's going to go down.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know about the C-section, but like,
I mean, you can see in that shot there's a giant gaping wound in the torso.
Yeah.
Of the person lying down.
Yeah.
So,
and it's Ned's hands. We talked about that in the main cast.
I mean, I would not be surprised if this is a fantasy section.
Mm. Well, and also if he actually uses, because we know he has Dawn, if he uses Dawn to do it, that would be you know, literally another bleeding, part of the bleeding star. So that's not looking so good for Brienne being Azor Ahai, or the princess that was promised.
Yeah.
Liz S. said, I've got some homemade tinfoil for you, inspired by Bran's latest series of visions. In one of the scenes, we see Wildfire ripping through the cellars underneath King's Landing, which is presumably a future version of Bran's, considering that this never happened during the Mad King's reign or during the Battle of the Blackwater. Mm-hmm. One theory circulating on the interwebs is that Cersei orders the Wildfire to be set off in an attempt to defeat the High Sparrow and his minions.
Right.
Perhaps because the mountain crumbles during her trial by combat, and now Cersei's life is truly in danger. This could also be an effective way of ridding Westeros of Margaery and the rest of the Tyrell clan. What if Jaime, upon his return from Riverrun, winds up killing Cersei in response to, or in a desperate attempt to prevent, this use of wildfire? I'm a big proponent of the Jaime as the Valonqar theory, and I also like to parallel with Jaime's prior murder of the Mad King in response to his attempted use of the wildfire to burn them all. A lot would have to happen for this to work. Presumably, Jaime's thirst for vengeance would need to be dampened a bit, which you could do by entering Brienne. Or Tommen would need to bite the dust in order for Maggie's prophecy to become relevant. But if we view Margaery as the one who casts Cersei down and takes all that she holds dear, then, well, perhaps this prophecy will play out sooner rather than later. Jim, what do you think of this? I do like the parallel between Jaime trying to do what's right and killing the Mad King and also killing Cersei.
Yeah, that's prevent. The most interesting part of this, for sure.
And I could also see Cersei, if Tommen gets killed in the tumult after this trial by combat. I don't think I included any of these theories, or maybe I included them in the podcast for next week, but a surprising number of people suggested that Tommen somehow is going to be her champion.
Why?
Because he's all convinced that he's holy and the gods will protect him.
But, so Cersei gets no say in who her champion is? Because I don't believe that Cersei would allow that.
No. That the High Sparrow will choose the king as his champion. The champion of faith.
Right. I thought we had talked about that in the podcast.
Maybe we did.
She'd have to choose whether or not to let the mountain kill Tommen.
Yeah.
By representing her.
You're right. So I don't think it's more likely that what in some kind of tumult over maybe the king says you just can't kill my mom and he gets killed in some kind of riot. It seems clear that the only way I think Cersei in her newly sane form is going to go crazy, go nuts, wanting to burn down the city is if Tommen does die and she thinks all is lost. The other interesting thing is in the books after Tywin dies, she has the Tower of the Hand burnt down. And there's this spectacular towering inferno and it collapses. And people are wondering if that's a pretty striking visual from the books. If there's a way that they can, do this with wildfire and kind of bring that imagery back into the show. That's another kind of, I guess, feather in this theory's cap. Anything else you want to talk about before we get on to our favorite topic, that of the Gravedigger and the ensuing climb ball? I probably fucked up the mics on that one.
You don't have to do that every time. I just insert the clip.
Oh, do you?
Yeah.
Oh, well, shit. Shit. All right. Well, I'll just say insert clip from now on. So Olivia D says this Sunday's episode is entitled The Broken Man. And I'm thinking this coming Monday, I can finally wear my Gravedigger t-shirt in public.
All right.
The Hound is indeed alive. In A Feast for Crows, Sept and Maribald has this interaction with Brienne and Podrick about broken men while on the Quiet Isle. From A Feast for Crows, Chapter 25, Brienne, the fifth Brienne chapter. Podrick asks, is a broken man an outlaw? And Brienne says, more or less. Sept and Maribald disagreed. More or less than more, there are many sorts of outlaws, just as there are many sorts of birds. A sandpiper and a sea eagle both have wings, but they are not the same. The singers love to sing of good men forced to go outside the law to fight some wicked lord, but most outlaws are more like this ravening hound than they are the lightning lord. They're evil men driven by greed, soured by malice, despising the gods and caring only for themselves. Broken men are more deserving of our pity, though they may be just as dangerous. So he's putting analogy between the hound and these broken men. This episode title is called... The Broken Man. There's also casting news that Ian McShane is, according to IMDb, going to be appearing.
Okay.
He is supposedly appearing as Septon Maribald, who is the character speaking here.
Right.
Looks like Gravedigger confirmed.
Good. Good.
So, just one step closer to the whole thing.
Hey, it's time for another season of Why is Mr. Feeny a Car? The premise is simple. A Gen Xer and a millennial watch old 80s action TV to see what still works and what doesn't. In previous seasons, we've done podcasts for Knight Rider, Airwolf, MacGyver, A-Team, and more. However, this year we're doing a very special season of Feeny. We're going back and reviewing the very special episodes of 80s and 90s sitcoms. Come cringe along with us as Hollywood tries to warn our families of the dangers of underage smoking, drug abuse, alcoholism, eating disorders, and much more. We start out with the episode of Boy Meets World where a high school kid gets sucked into a cult. Worlds collide as the Mr. Feeny finally makes an appearance on Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Join me and my buddy Jay each week for episodes full of nostalgia and secondhand embarrassment. And don't worry, if Very Special isn't your speed, we've also got some all-time classic Knight Rider episodes to close the season with. Find Why Is Mr. Feeny a Car? Each Wednesday on Bald Move Pulp, starting April 3rd.
FX is adapting James Clavell's best-selling novel, Shogun, into a 10-part miniseries this spring. Set in the shogunate period of Japan at the turn of the 15th century, Shogun depicts the rise of a feudal lord to Shogun, as seen through the eyes of a shipwrecked English sailor. It's loosely based on the real-life exploits of William Adams and Tokugawa Ieyasu.
Shogun has already been successfully adapted back in 1980 with a widely acclaimed miniseries starring Richard Chamberlain, featuring intricate plots, political scheming, complex characters, and thrilling action. This time, husband and wife team Justin Marks and Rachel Kondo try to recapture the successes of the novel and early adaptations while increasing the levels of historical and cultural accuracy that are often perceived as flaws of this and similar works.
Starring Hiroyuki Sanada from The Last Samurai, Mortal Kombat, and John Wick 4, with Cosmo Jarvis of Peaky Blinders, Raised by Wolves, etc., joining the truly massive cast required to bring this complex world to life. Join Aaron and I each week as we deep dive into each episode, uncovering the mysteries, the intrigue, and the glory of Shogun.
Shogun premieres on FX Hulu Tuesday, February 27th, with a two-part debut. Our podcast will release each Thursday thereafter. Get our Shogun coverage by searching for Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
Brian G said, "Hey guys, big fan with the impending Do you think that when the Gravedigger theory is proven true, they will explore the subtle love connection between Sansa and Sandor in some way?"
Sansa and
the Hound.
That's long dead.
I don't know that it was love so much as
you saved me.
Like the Hound maybe recognized that good things can happen and good people and there's things of love and beauty that are worth, you know, living and dying for, and not just, you know, the hell that he was locked into service of the Lannisters. I don't know that he legit felt reasonable romantic feelings for Sansa.
Yeah, I'm not so sure about that either.
But I am one to ship Brienne and Jaime, which is also a very subtle love connection, so I'm not saying you're wrong, just saying that I'm not picking up those vibes. So it would be
he's into her younger, more badass sister.
So he goes to Sansa's as too old,
yeah,
essentially.
Right. Uh-huh.
Well, we know how Arya treats that. Yeah, I don't see it myself, but hey, man, it's you're free to enjoy the show however you want. Hey, I wanted to remind everybody why we were talking about Gravedigger-type topics is we've got the RIP for the Mildly Interesting, which I know there's many, many, many new listeners, but back before Jim joined the Spoiler Podcast when he was a book virgin and people would write in or he would espouse a theory that I may or may not have had knowledge from the books, I would just say it's mildly interesting to cloak whether, you know.
Annoyed the crap out of me.
Yeah, well,
because I wanted to speculate and I wanted to bounce things off you. You just said mildly interesting.
Sure. But it bemused several people too. And this year, since you're joining it and kind of getting all spoiler friendly, there hasn't been a lot of mild interest to go around. And we had a t-shirt to commemorate it. Spoiler Morghulis, and it's got the Hound as a Gravedigger burying Mildly Interesting. It's a cool t-shirt. If you go to gravedigger.baldmove.com, we actually don't have it in the main store because this is arguably a spoiler and I don't want to piss any spoiler phobes off.
Yeah,
but if you want to get hyped about the impending Gravedigger and, you know, the rest of the stuff, you can go and get this pretty sweet looking t-shirt. It's designed by Bald Move's own Eric Walquist of Direct Podcast fame and Personal Arrogance fame, and I think it's pretty swanky. And as soon as Gravedigger becomes a thing, that we can talk about on the podcast, we're going to open to the general public. But if you want to get in and be the gravedigger hipster of Westeros, then get the gravedigger.baldmove.com. Would you like to help support Bald Move's podcast? I mean, the only way we're able to do the depth of coverage we do on Game of Thrones is because we do this as our full-time job. And not just this, we have a lot of other active podcasts. We're going to be starting up Mr. Robot Before You Know It. Orange is the New Black is coming down the pike. We're hip deep in Penny Dreadful, and we'll have Walking Dead in the fall. I hear Westworld finally got a fall release 2016. Date. We're going to be the rare first season jumping in with both feet podcast. We're pretty excited about it. That's HBO.
I'm scared, but fucking cool. But yeah, it seems real cool.
And the only reason we can do this stuff year-round is because of the generous support of our listeners. And if you go to club.baldmove.com, for just $1 a month, you too can become a club member, and you get all kinds of cool features like ad-free podcasts and special release podcasts. We are going to be playing through the last chapter of the Forrester Saga of the Telltale Game of Thrones video game. We're going to be doing a playthrough of that, and we kind of do it as a way to inject humor into a fairly grim series. And we also try to, wherever possible, be the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
Like if we're a handmaiden and we're supposed to protect our friend, we sell her out. Sell her out 6 ways from Sunday.
We tell people about her inappropriate relationship with the older guy.
Yeah. And, you don't want us talking about the special forest? Well, we're going to tell it to everybody we possibly can at every opportunity. A good time is had by all, and it's one of the many special things we do just for club members. You can actually see right now the first episode of that we played through last year if you want to get a taste of what it's like. But if you want to get all the rest of the episodes, including the final one, you got to be a club member. Club.baldmove.com. It supports independent podcasting and gets you some cool extra Bald Move features. Alex K says, can you talk about the internet theory that in the show, at least, the heir apparent to the Iron Throne is now Jaime, especially since he's been removed from King's Guard? How do you think this will play out? My first thought was, you're full of shit, Alex K. Jaime is a Lannister, that he is not in the Lions of Succession anywhere. But then I started doing some research, and I found this article on Mashable, which I'll include, that lays out the genealogy here. I'm going to quote directly from the article. You have to go back to Robert Baratheon's great-great-great-great-grandfather to find anyone in his family who sired another line that survived. 150 years before Robert was born, an aristocrat called Corwin Baratheon married a woman named Leni and had 6 kids. One of them, Arian, was Robert's great-great-great-grandfather. The next one down to have surviving kids was Eliana, who married a lord named Mathen, Lord Mathen Lannister. Mathen fathered Jason, who fathered Daemon, who fathered Gerald, who fathered Tytos Lannister. And who was Tytos' firstborn son? Tywin Lannister.
Okay.
The firstborn son of Tywin was Jaime, which means that through a improbable line of succession that Jaime could be amongst the ones who could inherit the Iron Throne. And now he's cleared of his Lord Commander status and could do so. What is your reaction to the possibility of Jaime being a king in Westeros, the king of Westeros?
I just don't see it happening. I think there are much more obvious and satisfying candidates for me. You know, John or Danny being two others, to name a few.
Yeah.
I don't know. It doesn't seem very plausible to me.
It doesn't either. And, you know, people
I can't say exactly why, though.
People are like, well, why did George include all this genealogy in his various sources?
Mm-hmm.
Because, like, in the appendix, there's a lot of this stuff. And, of course, in the world of Ice and Fire, you get even more. And I just think it's like, he gets off on it, man. Like, he really likes imbuing, mm-hmm. much like Tolkien before him, of the world and his real history that might not necessarily be relevant, but it's stuff that he can pull on for other things. And, mm-hmm. you know, he had that work out the timeline of the Baratheons so he'd explain why Robert had the best claim to the throne amongst all the rebellion. I don't know what. So if we think Jaime's going to be the Valonqar, and maybe he's not, maybe he's going to be the Hound. But if we think he's going to be Valonqar, then that seems like that's the point of his story. And also, maybe he sits on the Iron Throne, but is that where he ends up? Because I just don't see a world like it. I don't feel like Jaime's going to survive this series.
Yeah,
every
one
either. Of his children is going to be murdered. His sister wife is likely going to be murdered.
Mm-hmm.
He seems more of a tragic figure, and he also has to atone for his many sins.
That's true.
namely chucking Bran out of a window for no damn good reason. I feel like that he's going to have to pay for his life for all that. So maybe he does temporarily, but long term, I don't think it's the solution. But it wasn't as crazy as I thought when Alex first darkened my email box with it. Julie G says, I have an idea. Perhaps Jorah will head to the Citadel and Archmaester Marwyn, a.k.a. Marwyn the Mage. He meets Marwyn the Mage. After all this time in Essos, he could easily have heard about this renegade Archmaester with the most experience and interest in the Far East and magic. They can introduce him on the show via Sam as in the books. From the wiki of Ice and Fire, Marwyn spent 8 years in the East mapping distant lands, searching for lost books, and studying with warlocks and shadowbinders. He was nicknamed Marwyn the Mage by Archmaster Valin after his return. The name was soon all over Old Town, much to Valin's vast annoyance. He often calls the rest of the maesters the Grey Sheep. He also, as a minor book footnote, is encountered Miri Mazdur, who is the witch that, quote-unquote, healed Khal Drogo for Dany.
Okay.
And he's the one that taught her the secrets of the human body and the common tongue and how to do some of her blood magic sorcery. We also know from the books that Marwyn hears about Dany and her dragons from Sam, and he promptly hightails it to Meereen. I think Marwyn definitely has a role to play in the rest of the series, so having him be the source of help, or at least someone who could be sought out by Jorah for help, makes sense to me. Even if he isn't Jorah's savior, do you think he enters the story in the show similar to the books? I don't see any way how they avoid... I mean, why is Sam going to the Citadel if not to meet this guy?
Right, I mean, the Citadel kicks a lot of doors open.
Yes.
For a lot of those types of characters, and maybe, you know, I don't know the specifics on these, but certainly I guess Marwyn could be one of those. It feels like a beginning to a story once he reaches the Citadel, not any kind of end goal. So,
and
a lot
also,
of new stuff.
As we talked, there's some sand snakes operating undercover in Old Town.
Right.
There's a lot of kind of plots that are nexusing there. Interestingly, Jack and Hagar is spotted, or at least people think he's spotted in Old Town doing some bullshit there too. So yeah, I don't see any way that they don't have this character in some form. And also, he could be Martin Razor. He could be Martin's Razor into the guy holding the horn. He could be Martin's Razor into the guy that cures Jorah's grayscale, which is already a Martin Razor for a Martin's Razor. There's a lot of things he could be, essentially kind of like a combination of the Red Priest that Victarion fishes out of the sea and heals his hand, and the guy that brings the horn. Like, there's a lot of pieces that he could help solve for the puzzle. So I like that theory. I like that theory a lot. Axel Foley says, I think Tyrion as a Targaryen is a actual reversed plot line. I think the Mad King raped Tywin's wife and the result was Jaime and Cersei. He hated Tyrion because he knew he was actually his only true son. So that has a charm of actually working more in the line of what the timeline, what we're dealing with, which is the Aerys took advantage of first night rights.
The twins were...
Yeah, so the twins would be his and not so much Tyrion.
Yeah, then you don't have to say, oh, well, he maybe continued to take rights over and over.
Yeah, and it also would explain why, you know, Tywin would be so bitter. Like, my only true son is this misshapen dwarf that everyone hates, and he killed my wife, and woe is me. The only thing I don't like about it is Tyrion as a secret Targaryen opens up a lot of cool, like, Tyrion riding dragons, and which gives him a good use for his saddle-making technology, although it doesn't seem like Dany needs saddles.
No, she just barebacks that thing.
Yep.
No problem.
Yep, seems like she just got the... She's got the killer grip with her thighs, and...
Some pointy boots.
Yep.
She's good to go.
Yep, there's the dragon scales naturally kind of rough and gritty and gives you good purchase. It doesn't feel like custom-made saddles might be a necessity. Now, if you're a dwarf...
Right. It's tough to get your legs around a dragon, I imagine.
Yeah. Impin ain't easy, and that extends to riding dragons, so maybe he has to custom whip one up for himself. Or...
Maybe.
There's also theory that dragon or the Brandon might be a dragon rider, although that theory usually involves him actually warging into a dragon,
right?
Which is pretty badass,
and
also would explain why the Three-Eyed Raven says, "By the time you're done, you'll learn to fly."
Yeah,
I just want to throw that out, and this is stuff we've all discussed in previous.
Although
podcasts.
I would say seeing through the eyes of a raven would probably also qualify.
Yep. You know, if people, if going up in an airplane counts as flying, then seeing through a bird's eyes, I would imagine, would do that as well. Stephen M. says, I just finished reading the book of Duncan Egg, and it got me thinking about how Prince Arian demanded a trial by seven. Could the High Sparrow and company do the same thing, seeing as how they should have knowledge of Sir Robert the Strong?
Whoa. Trial by seven. I'll explain that. Okay.
This could cause Cersei to go out and find six other champions when Jaime and Bronn are stuck at Riverrun. I think this could be an epic way to end the season with a fantastic Trial by Seven battle with the Faith using people like Lancel, Loras, some other Faith militant members, even the Kingsguard with their new armor, and revealing the Gravedigger and Hound as their seventh combatant. So a Trial by Seven is essentially a 7-on-7, 14-man battle royale.
Nice.
And to establish the truth of a matter.
It's a Royal Rumble.
It is. It's literally a Royal Rumble. And it's based in the faith of the seven, because essentially you're calling on all aspects of the seven gods, not just one particular one.
Okay.
Like, it's assumed that, like, the warrior is the one overseeing kind of, like, the one-on-one combat.
Sure,
you get, yeah. You, that's not good enough. You can get the stranger and the crone and the maiden and the smith and everybody else in there. I gotta admit, that would be pretty cunning if, you know, he says, well, according to ancient texts, we could do, you know, you've got this one big dude. Well, now we're going to make it 7-on-7, and maybe you all gang up on Sir Robert and even the odds real quick.
Maybe they can. I don't know. I've seen these multi-person fighting.
That's the first thing I thought about.
Fighting tournaments, and it always goes down that the first team to lose a man it ends up losing the whole thing.
Yep.
Because then they just team up on other guys. So, like, I imagine the Mountain could fight off several people at once. And if the other six of Cersei's guys gang up on one of their guys, well, they're just going to slaughter him.
Especially if one of those ends up being, the Hound. Like, a badass in his own right.
Yeah, I don't know. But then you look at, like, Ned and Howlin at the Tower of Joy, and it's like, well, they took out...
Yeah, sure.
X amount of Ned's guys. So.
Yeah. I know that was like the best swordsman in the Seven Kingdoms, but still, right. Your point's well taken. I gotta say, I do like the idea of it's just a seven-man brawl. Like, it's we haven't seen very many satisfying one-on-one sword fights. It seems like you got Oberyn and like Brienne and like Jaime and Brienne's fights, but there's not a lot of the Sir Arthur Dayne was pretty badass, but like I didn't think that like Ned versus Jaime was all that great. It got ended before it got going by the Lannister guy stabbing Ned in the leg. Not that I think Ned could actually beat Jaime in a straight up sword fight anyway.
Not with his good hand, no.
So I like sword fights. 7-on-7, as long as they get the choreography pretty sweet, it'd be pretty nice. Pretty nice. I guess Jorah he's had a bunch of good fights too.
Yeah, and
Barristan, his last stand.
He got one.
Maybe I'm undervaluing the swordplay in the series. Ryan from Connecticut says, in this last week's episode, Blood of My Blood, the scene where Walder Frey is berating his two lower-level henchmen. My takeaway from that scene is that he identified them as the actual hitmen from the Red Wedding, which you're correct. One slit Kat's throat, and the other stabbed Rob's wife.
Yeah,
and
killed the baby.
Yeah. The only reason I feel to ID these guys now so that the viewer knows who they are when they get killed in the next few episodes and it carries more weight. Doesn't a trope say that if you see Chekhov's gun in Act 1, then Chekhov's gun has to be killed by the Brotherhood Without Banners and Cat Stark's reanimated corpse in Episode 7, 8, or 9?
Yeah.
I feel like these two guys may as well be wearing red shirts from Star Trek. So here's my take on this, because we've talked about the Grand Northern Conspiracy, which I went into... two or three part detail in previous season of the podcast, but one of the main players here is Lord Manderly, which was mentioned previously as someone that might be joining with the Boltons. And the way we're introduced to him in the books is that Davos goes to try to talk him into fighting on Stannis' side, and he has three Freys in his house, and he's entertaining them as guests, and he summarily not only just dismisses Davos, but he actually cuts off his head, except for he doesn't. He puts him in his dungeon to protect him, takes some other rando that looks kind of like him.
It's just an onion in a wig.
It's just an onion. Yeah, it's just a carved onion.
Right.
Who could tell the difference? He cuts off the fake Davos's head and dips it in tar and mounts it to the city gate so that the Frey's like, oh yeah, he did what we told him to do.
Right.
Later, after they leave, he gets him out of the dungeon, apologizes for it, and says, look, I've just been lying to these people because me and some other unnamed northern lords are going to fuck them butt good.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of inference here, but these three Freys go to ride off to Winterfell to witness the wedding of fake Arya Stark to Ramsay Bolton. Lord Manderly makes a big show of giving them gifts, which is the traditional Westeros way of saying you're no longer my guests. And then he has his men ambush them on the road and kill them. He then butchers them and bakes them into three immense mincemeat pies. Immense mincemeat. Well, that's a tough one to say. Then he goes to Winterfell himself to show allegiance to his lord, carrying these giant pies and a huge supply of food and drink, which he conspicuously only drinks from his own supply, which a lot of people say, well, that means Lord Manderly, he's being very cautious and conscious to not violate the guest right, because he washed his hands of the Freys before he killed him, and he's not taking advantage of the guest right under Ramsay's house and the Bolton house, because he's brought his own food and drink, so he's not eating their bread or salt, so he can fuck with the Boltons with impunity. And he also does a lot of things that provoke the Boltons and the Freys. Like, he demands the bard sing the Rat Cook song, which is an ancient, which is a kind of a song about this old legend about the Rat Cook, who was a cook at the Night Fort, who became infamous when he served an Andal king a pie that was made of bacon and the king's son. The cook killed the prince in revenge for the wrong the king supposedly did to him, but the king was unaware of this. However, as he ate and praised the taste and asked for a second piece.
Right. Scott Tenenbaum.
And the gods were angered not because the cook had committed the murder, but because he had made, and not because he had made the king a cannibal, but because the cook had slain a guest beneath his roof.
And it was poorly seasoned.
Yes. So this is essentially Lord Manderly flaunting the fact, unbeknownst to the Boltons and the Freys, that he's done this and he's serving them their own family.
Right.
And ha ha. And I'm about to. Now, it kind of goes wrong because in a fight that ensues amongst the revelry, Lord Manderly gets his throat slit. But he's also a super fat dude with like multiple chins. It's made like an explicit point in the book. And it seems like his fat was so thick around his neck.
Really?
That it didn't kill him. And a maester was able to save him. And that's kind of where we leave things now. But then, but then we get the pink letter that claims that the Boltons have cleaned house and they've killed Stannis. And a lot of people say that that's actually not what happened. And what we're going to find out is that there's like a bunch of chaos at Winterfell, and I don't know, because then I start losing the plot, because there's other chapters that advance the plot a little bit that's been released as preview chapters in The Winds of Winter, which I still steadfastly have refused to read. But that's kind of like where I'm getting at, is that it is interesting that they are making a big deal out of these two particular Freys being the ones that did the stabbing. Roose Bolton, who's the one that killed, I guess, put the final knife in Robb Stark's chest,
yep,
already dead. It would be interesting if we then later meet a northern lord and there is some of this inference where they've been killed and murdered and served as pies. The only thing I guess I don't understand is where would the pies be going, because the marriage has already taken place. Where would there be another celebration? Is it something where the Boltons are going to think that they've crushed, or there's going to be some feast of welcome for all the northern lords and they're going to do a reverse red wedding, except for it's not going to be a wedding?
It could be. I wonder if it's to, like, I don't know, consecrate the relationship that that Umber
between the Umbers
is setting up.
Sure, sure.
Maybe some kind of celebration that, hey, we got a Stark.
Yeah.
It does. I don't know.
Yeah, it does seem that the Umbers might actually be for the Umbers and the Karstarks might actually, even though this boggles my mind as a book reader, maybe they are actually Bolton allies, because, you know, as we saw in the preview, yeah, the preview trailers, that the Boltons and Umbers are fighting against the Wildling army and Jon in unison, which is pretty far to sell a prank.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, what do you think of all that?
Who knows? I mean, shit, it could be that the Umbers are working with Catelyn. I mean, it's...
Right.
I don't know. The show feels like it has already kind of I won't say abandoned threads that are in the book, but yeah, like remixed them in such a way that it's hard to tell where they're coming from at this point.
And it's also standing here at episode 6, right?
Mm-hmm.
I am kind of shocked that they've dropped the Umber plot for so long and kind of the Bolton plot and all that, because I felt like that would be something that would be immediately dealt with.
Yeah.
I don't quite understand, because it feels like they're just running, once again, they're kind of running out of time to do all the things they need to do.
I don't know. Could make for an exciting last few seasons.
Because my assumption has always been that the Boltons and Freys will be dealt with in this season, that Daniel will be sailing to Westeros, and the next two seasons are all about the thing we actually care about, which is the war for Westeros and also, you know, the war for the Dawn, essentially, the turn back to night. And if they have all this, you know, all this stuff we're talking about now is bullshit, it's non-essential, and if they don't have that dispensed with before the final 13 episodes, I don't know.
I think they can do it with the next four.
That's 4 hours of television, and a lot can happen.
Right.
But I'll be concerned if some of this doesn't start coming together. I mean, because to me, like, next episode is going to be a lot about... did you watch the preview?
I haven't yet, no.
I did. I can barely remember what all had happened, except for that it does seem like it's going to feature the Hound and the Gravedigger theory prominently. But that's, you know, you could do that in 5 minutes. I don't know.
Let me ask you something real quick. Yeah. So in regards to the Hound and Clegane Bowl and stuff,
Wait. Don't you mean Clegane Bowl?
In the books, we don't really know that it's the Hound, right? Like, nobody recognizes that it's the Hound. How do you do that with visual medium?
That's a good, because that's why one of the reasons that all the people who are kind of double cross, fake out people, they're either revealed right away or they don't even bother to do it.
Right.
And I assumed that Brienne would recognize the Hound, she fought the dude.
Yes.
You're right. Now,
I mean, cloak him up.
What you could do. You just, like, Brienne is walking along and talking to this guy, and she's asking him what happened to the Hound, and he mentions that he was dead and that he's at peace now. And at the very end of the scene, they're like, we're walking over a bridge, and underneath the bridge is Sandor. Like, it's not in Brienne's line of sight, and he, like, turns to the camera, and we see it's Sandor.
And he winks.
But Brienne, he winks. He winks.
Goes, okay.
And gives us a
thumbs
up.
So she's not actually talking to Sandor.
No.
She's talking to another
monk. She's talking to another guy. So, like, the reveal.
Sandor's digging graves.
It was just, they essentially manipulate the sight lines.
Okay, sure. They could do that.
I think that's how they would probably do it.
Now, I don't know that these things are mutually exclusive necessarily, but what, in your opinion, I guess would be more satisfying? Getting. Or having kind of this stuff with Cersei go down in a way that, like, Tommen gets killed and the High Septon, like, she has to use wildfire on the city or whatnot. Like, I don't know that if...
Why not both is what I'm saying.
Right. I don't know how Tommen gets killed unless via, like, trial by combat somehow.
Hmm.
Like, I mean, is he trying to... Come in and protect his mother after the mountain loses, or
yeah,
like
no, like if the mountain loses and he's
that's
faced,
why I
he's
say all, they're not mutually exclusive necessarily,
because they did set up the central conflict of him feeling like he failed his mother by not protecting her, and
right.
That's what the king should do. Like even if you buy all this High Sparrow's bullshit, like if a king can't protect his own mother,
sure,
and if that comes the pass, I could see him just refusing to assent and him getting killed. Because like also. I think we might see a full-blown riot in the you know, Great Sept of Baelor, or wherever they're going to do this trial by combat,
mm-hmm.
Because like the people seem very clearly ready to turn on the powers that be for defying what they see is justice.
Right.
And nobody likes, like, it seems very, like, even the High Septon said, look, if Margaery makes her walk for Tommen, it ain't going to go down like Cersei.
Yeah.
Because Margaery's well-liked by the people, Cersei everyone hates. So I think that you could easily have a situation where the mountain loses to whomever,
mm-hmm.
and then Tom and can't accept the judgment. The people go into a riot, like King's Landing is being torn apart, and kind of similar to where that one melee where like Joffrey almost got pulled off his horse and Sansa almost got raped, and like that already almost happened.
Yep.
This just full on happens, and they tear Tommen apart, and maybe Jaime's able to save Cersei.
Cersei gets pissed. And Cersei's just the city, like, you know, fuck what? These fuck people. All, yeah. Fuck the High Septon.
Because she's blaming the people. Like, this is just like what happened to Joffrey, and these people are a bunch of vicious idiots that don't appreciate anything.
Yeah.
I'm going to burn them all. We already know she knows about the wildfire. Or do we? Do we know that?
I think so.
Because I know for a fact in the books that she was kind of behind the wildfire, and that, Tyrion found out about it and subverted it for his own ends. But he also had this kind of cool chain plot going on, too.
I want to say she knows about it.
I do. I think that she's going to know about it, and she's... And for sure, she'd have to know, because Jaime had to tell her the stories.
About the Mad King and why he killed the sheriff.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure Tyrion found out because Cersei was having them make the wildfire on her behalf. So, I think that seems like we kind of that compelling case for what's going to happen at the tail end of the season. Probably episode 9, because that's when they like to do shit like this.
Uh-huh.
And then episode 10's for the shot of hope in the arm. It's going to be, you know, Dany sallying forth, and maybe Jon and Sansa triumphant of some kind of thing. I don't know. So that's all we got for the spoiler edition this week. As always, you can send us feedback at gameofthrones@baldmove.com and on forums.baldmove.com. Once again, we will be releasing a day early, so you have less time to get your email back sent in next week because of my father's surgery. Also, by the way, thanks for the many, 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 many people that for expressing sympathy and good wishes on my father's behalf. I appreciate that. Made me feel good about everything. So we will have the full cast out on Monday, a day early. Look for that. We'll be back with instant cast this Sunday night. Should be a memorable one. Until then, I'm Aaron.
And I'm Jim.
Bye-bye.